try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal.
Protonic reversal with your host, Conan Neutron. Broadcasting from a secret underground lair in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A gigantic middle finger to everything that is rock about music, rock and roll, and corporate power.
The thing is, though, if you don't laugh, you're going to go on a killing spree with sharp and nails.
Confidence of a hero or a fool, I wasn't exactly certain which.
Could not be more professional.
It means something.
And they got away.
You know, that's my take. What's yours?
Protonic reversal!
That's like a science thing, right?
Indeed, indeed, indeed it is. It is a science thing. It is a science place. It is a scientific fact that we are all up in your face. It is time once again for the one, the only, Protonic Reversal. Welcome to it, welcome to it, welcome to it. Hey, episode 439. Wow, that's a very large number of podcasts. It's a long time been doing the show, actually. I was thinking about it. Tonight's guest, who we'll be getting to shortly, has been on four times on his own and one time with Deep Tunnel Project. And that's a lot. That's a lot of art. It's a lot of activity to cover, and tonight's kind of special. Looking forward to tonight, just as I am all the rest of them. Before we do that, two things: Code Neutron, the Secret Friends dates coming up. October, we're playing Chicago, Minneapolis, Lincoln, Denver, Salt Lake City. Why do I make myself do this from memory? Boise, Eugene, Portland, and Seattle for Rat City Recon, which is going to be fantastic. We have November dates coming as well. Rat City Recon, that's with Pistons and Austerity Program, God Boys, a bunch of great bands. It's going to be amazing. Code Neutron, Secret Friends, NeutronFriends.com, NeutronFriends.bandcamp.com. I will have Protonic Reversal stickers and maybe other merch. We'll see. People said they want more of that. I'm like, great, fine. If you want Protonic stuff, go to the Secret Friends merch table. It makes sense. November, we're doing Kansas City, Jackson, Mississippi, Atlanta, Georgia, New Orleans, Austin, Denton, Wichita, Santa Fe, and Phoenix. And there's somebody really cool in December as well. Cool. Enough about that. Welcome to Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. I am your host, Conan Neutron. I'm a rock and roll lifer that's been touring and recording for 25 years, most known for the band Conan Neutron, The Secret Friends. Music is a huge part of my life, and I use the format of this very long-running show to talk about music with musicians whose work I enjoy and respect, but who may not be household names. Now, this is episode 439. Now, if this is your first time listening to the show, archives are available for free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding, at protonicreversal.com. However, if you want to support the show and get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal will achieve that goal. And if you like the show or even just a single episode, please feel free to like, subscribe on your platform of choice, share it around the internet, even leave a review. All that helps people discover the show. It beats back the almighty algorithmic overlords. And it's just a darn nice thing to do. So let me tell you, I did not expect in the year 2025, which has been full of surprises, some of them good, most of them bad, to be talking about silkworm news. But I am overjoyed and excited to be doing so, and in just under the wire, if I may, before stuff actually happens. Let's bring them back. Again, this is a fifth appearance. We're not going to count the Deep Tunnel Project. That's its own thing. So fifth asterisk of Mr. Tim Midget. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks.
Good big to be news. I decided to look before doing the show this time instead of doing the normal thing where I just kind of, I think it's been like, and nobody cares, by the way.
Yeah.
Nobody cares at all. They're like, we don't care about that. So thrilling and unexpected compliment to have silkworm stuff happening. Now tell me about this, because this is with Joel,
yeah,
too. So it's sort of like a continuation of, I don't know if we call it Silkworm Mark 1, but the first few albums, it's in your own words, which is going to be way better than my complete inarticulate way of summarizing it, please tell me what's going on with Silkworm.
Well, long story short, we had a long career as a band with Joel Phelps in the band, and Joel started the band in 87 and in Montana. And so the band existed in Montana for a few years, then we moved to Seattle and existed there for 4 years. 7 years into the band, Joel quit. And then after Joel quit, that's kind of when things picked up for us a little bit. Me and Andy and Michael Dahlquist, the drummer, Andy Cohen, the guitar player. You know, we played for 11 years after that.
Yeah.
And we were on Matador and Touch and Go and stuff, and put out a bunch of records and toured with bands that where people would come and see him play and stuff. But not that many people even saw the quartet version of the band way back when, you know.
Yeah.
So it was always, I wouldn't say it was lost to history or anything, but, and it didn't really dawn on me until very recently that that was the case, you know, that so many more people were familiar with the Slatterday version of the band insofar as anyone was familiar with us. So, anyway, it just never, you know, we were always friends, and, but you know, Joel lived all the way out on the, in Vancouver, BC, where he's been for a long time. And Andy and I migrated to Chicago for the last days of the Worm. And then, I don't know, it never occurred to any of us to start doing it again until, Steve Albini died, who was our great pal and, you know, recorded everything we did or was involved with every record we made after about 92. So, you know, very long, fruitful relationship with the band in addition to just being a dear friend. So anyway, we all ended up being at his memorial and we realized, well, this is kind of the time to do this if we're going to try to play together again.
While everybody still can. And
while no one has rheumatoid arthritis. And and we all still have all our fingers and stuff so far. So, yeah, and it went great and it felt really good. And the thing that really made me think, should we do this more? And Andy, too, was that we got to play with Joel, you know. He's back. He had he had issues with alcohol addiction and stuff that he's been sober for a long time now. And it was just so great to play with him again. And, you know, Jeff Panhall, who's filling in on drums, is, you know,
he's great. I've seen him play with him.
He's a great drummer. And it just felt good. So we thought, do we want to do this more? And we thought we would give it a shot. Yeah.
Well, and it's so interesting because, you know, I consider myself a huge Silkworm fan, and the fact that I think I counted, I have 3 t-shirts in varying states of decay, I might add.
Yeah.
And, you know, huge fan of the band, but I came in kind of right as you turned into a trio.
Yeah.
And so I knew in the West,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't really, it was like years later that I didn't go back to the other ones. And I don't know why. I have no reason, like, I just, for whatever reason, just didn't. Like, I went forward with you guys, but, like, it took me, like, 10 years before I find, like, oh, yeah, maybe I should listen to these earlier records. I don't know why.
It's funny, and it didn't dawn on me until we started doing this again. I was like, you know, I don't think more than, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 people maybe saw us play with Joel, and we played shows that big with Shellac or Pavement or whatever, like, single shows. So, it was pretty crazy to realize that because it always just seemed like a continuum to me, you know.
Right, because it certainly, the feel, obviously with Joel singing, you know, with a different singer, that's always going to be different. But it kind of felt like when Joel left, you just sort of worked around, like more room kind of appeared in the music. And in a cool way, but in a way that's kind of fascinating if you go back to it later and like listen to the early stuff. It's like, oh, wow, okay. Like, how did I not vibe on? Like, and it seems totally up my alley just for whatever reason. I just came to it. You know, later
it got looser with the three of us because we could stretch out and do kind of whatever more. You know, there's more room for the bass to noodle around, and Andy could really stretch out. But there's a very cool element to the sound with Joel and the band, mostly because he's a great musician, a great guitar player, great writer and singer. So, you know, there's all this stuff that that went away when he left. You know, we weren't going to keep playing that stuff. So.
Well, and he, you know, he went on his own. He did some fantastic music on his own as great well. Music. And everybody grew as songwriters and musicians.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, and you know, just Bottomless Pit was fantastic. You know, I'm a fan. You know, all the Mint Miles stuff, the great record that Andy did with like Coma. I mean, there's everybody's kind of been not frozen in amber necessarily this entire time. You know, everybody's been doing stuff, but there is something. There is something kind of poignant and cool about you guys getting together to do anything, frankly, again, but especially to do it with Joel. That's something that's kind of special and that's kind of neat. And maybe something that I didn't even understand the profundity of all that until I saw the documentary, the Can You Wait documentary, which, by the way, it took me so long to track down my copy of that. I have a digital copy. I'm like, what hard drive is this even on? I don't know. Like, I remember it. I remember the beats of everything. It'd be cool to rewatch it. I did find it, by the way. but it's when it's all laid out like that, you really get a larger sense of the story that maybe you're not going to get where it's like, oh yeah, that record's good. I've got that one. You know, that's the one. That's the one. That's the concept record about drinking, right? Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one everyone has, and yes, it is. So there is something kind of cool that you guys, because it's not like you guys have been out of each other's lives. You know, like Andy showed up on the Mint Mile stuff, and you know, you keep in touch. But to do it as Silkworm and to do it with Joel is really interesting because it's someone that basically missed the larger portion of Silkworm being a larger, as larger maybe the wrong term, proposition to the world at large.
Yeah,
with like years of touring and playing like great big shows, maybe to sometimes perplexed audiences, but you get to do something with that lineup that you didn't get to do before as, lack of a better term, grown-ups that have also musically progressed. So it has to be like immediately familiar, but then also kind of like, oh wow, that's interesting. And that's new at the same time.
I think if I felt like it was just a good old days type thing, we wouldn't be doing it. Cause I don't really, you know, we have a song called Don't Look Back that we're playing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I believe in that. You know, I don't think Don't Look Back, Something Might Be Gaining on You, that whole thing. So I don't really want to do that. And, it didn't feel like that. It felt like the past came rushing up to now, and it just filled up now. And it didn't feel like it wasn't like, oh yeah, we're gonna play these '90s songs, and it's gonna be all '80s, '90s music. You know, it just felt new. You know, and plus Joel's playing on all this other stuff, you know, that he never touched before, and he's playing all this cool shit. And the first time we got together and really woodshedded, we've gotten together 3 times since the memorial, and they're kind of grueling weekends because we'll play for like 3 days. We'll play for like, you know, 6, 6, and 9 hours or something like that.
Right. Yeah. 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 It's like we've an endurance contest.
Never done it before. And it just happened. And we do it every, we've done it all 3 of these weekends that we've done it. But the first one, I remember Joel was, we started playing something, and Andy just looked at me with this like look of like shock on his face, and I thought maybe he wasn't into it or something, and afterwards he was like that's so rocking, he's like it sounded like enormo, you know. And you know, you can't there's something to be said for what the people you grew up playing with, if you spend as much time together as we did, you know, hours and hours, and we learned to play together, I mean literally, as a group. So when we do that now, it's just like there, you know, and it's really cool to hear it just kind of go click and, you know, lock into place. It's fun.
Well, and it's interesting too, because Silkworm was always a rather unorthodox band by, I guess, most people's standards of what a traditional band would be. But
I came to accept that over time,
but I think consider that a compliment. Most of my favorite bands are, you know, when I think of like what traditional, Aerosmith, like what are we talking about?
Think any band that I love, there's something about them like, you know, we don't sound like the Magic Band at all, but there's only one band that sounds like that.
Yeah.
You know,
and, there should only be one band that sounds like
that's
that.
That's it. Or Crazy Horse or New Order or, you know, whatever. Like, there's only one. Like, why is there only one Kraftwerk? It seems like other people should be able to do that. But no, you know, and I know I'm putting us in that company, but I do think we're in a pretty unusual group.
No, I mean, because there's something to be said for things that are idiosyncratic. There's something to be said for things that are unique. And a lot of times early instincts from younger bands are going to be, oh, we should sound more like this or more like that. It's like, no, you should, whatever it is that makes you, you, lean into that as hard as you can.
Yeah, we didn't have a scene, you know, we didn't have, we in Seattle, we weren't listening to MC5, like all those bands or whatever. We just kind of came across whatever we came across and just made it up as we went along. And not that those bands didn't do that, but they bounced off each other more, you know, we didn't have anyone to bounce off of.
Right. But you're also coming off of, like, you know, coming from Missoula, coming from a much smaller town. Mm-hmm. A much smaller pool. I love Missoula to death, but, you know, it's not exactly.
No, especially then, you know, there was no, you're stuck in the mountains. And records would get in there, or fanzines or whatever, through the college kids. But, you know, yeah, you had to make it up as you saw fit. You know, we didn't have any guidelines or whatever. You know, we just kind of hacked away at it until it sounded cool to us. And really, but the main thing is, like, for me and Andy, we learned how to do it from Joel, because Joel's 4 years older than
me. He had a little more seasoning in the world.
He was fully developed. I mean, it wasn't even like we were juveniles and he was, like, you know, the guy. He wrote all this stuff that I don't know. We couldn't even touch it, you know, until later. It really took until about 93 before we kind of had our act together enough to sort of quote unquote compete with him, you know.
But he just had a head start at doing it too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And we listening to him, like, yeah, I would write songs that were derivative, or Andy would write songs where he would have ideas and he would just try to make the idea shoehorned into a song. And Joel, it was just this flow state, you know,
and just all there.
That's how I learned how to do that, was I saw him do it and I was like, I have no idea what this means, but you feel it.
Yeah. But so you notice it makes a difference, right? Yeah.
It makes a huge difference because it's all emotion and there's no thinking. I mean, there's some critical editing stuff that would come later, but he would just let it go. And he didn't cut things out because they made him uncomfortable or whatever. So seeing someone else do that, and him and John Kappas, who's the leader of Einheit, those two guys, like, that's how I learned how to do it. Don't put extra shit in there just to impress yourself or whatever. Just let go of your logical part of your brain and just let it come out. And then you can mess around with that later, you know.
When you said something very interesting too, which, you know, the first time when I did go back to the earlier Silkworm stuff with Joel, like, the first thing I noticed is, like, oh, wow, this is just incredibly present emotionally, like, just in a way that I wasn't used to, because I was just hearing, like, you three guys, which I loved, and then I was like, wow, what's this, who's this other dude, what is this guy up to, this is crazy. And then I finally got what everyone was going on about, that, like, you gotta listen to those early records. Okay I will.
He's very I mean, he went through some rough stuff, you know, when he was in Missoula and stuff, but that was part of it. And then a lot of it was just, like, he wasn't afraid to sort of lay himself bare like that, you know, and that takes an emotional toll on someone to do that. And I think that was part of why he didn't want to maybe be in the band anymore touring. Cause it's one thing to do that in front of your friends. And it's another thing to do it in, like, Tulsa, you know,
Ripping your soul out to four people in Oklahoma. Great. You know, spooky,
white power guys that came to the bar or whatever.
Yeah. So, well, and that's, and also, you know, touring isn't for everybody too.
At the time I was like, Joel's laming out, you know, and he doesn't, you know, whatever. He's like, he's burned out or whatever. He's like kind of letting us down. And then, like, looking back on it, I'm like, who wants to, you're sleeping on promoters' floors and you're making like $100 a night or whatever sometimes, and barely breaking even on these grueling tours. Like, no wonder. That was kind of the reasonable thing, was not to do it.
Sleep on a hardwood floor. What, and give up show business?
Exactly. Yeah.
Brutal. Well, yeah. And that's something where it's interesting, because you guys didn't stop. You developed your own voice as that same band on a sort of, like, parallel universe sort of track, right? Where, and then that even turned into the more, after the hard touring worm kind of slowed down. I mean, I think, like, those last records are remarkable, where you're able to kind of put that forward in another in another way. You know, you have the keyboards and stuff that came in, things along those lines. And it's just, like, it makes sense. But it's one of those things that I think if you're a fan of the band, it's reasonable to just be, like, pleasantly surprised. To be like, wait, what? What's happening?
Yeah. Yeah. There were songs on the earliest stuff that we did of Joel's that are really super great. And we're playing at least one of those. And I think we just kept morphing, and it wasn't a conscious thing, obviously. It was just, maybe not obviously, but we weren't thinking, well, we should try to do this. We just, like, things just started happening differently.
Right. You know?
But I think there's a through line in all of it, and I think that'll be apparent to anyone who comes to these shows. Like, we play the oldest stuff right next to the newer stuff, and it's, you know, it's not the same, but it has the same kind of thrust to it, you know.
So two things. First of all, does it just clicked immediately with everyone? It was just immediately right there. That's great.
Yeah, because everyone wanted to do it, so people were prepared.
Yeah.
And I had played with Panel a lot because this is all new to him. I mean, he has by far the biggest lift.
A legendary drummer? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No big deal, right?
Great, you know. And it's funny, too, because he's the hardest things for him were things on the first couple record, on, like, In the West.
Yeah.
A couple of songs, Dreammate and Garden City Blues, that have a little bit of kind of fidgety beats.
Yeah, where he's kind of like, kind of awkward.
Yeah, and the reason they're like that is Michael could not, he wasn't that great of a drummer, but he was inventive. So he came up with these weird, and Jeff was trying to do like, on the kick drum or whatever. And I'm like, dude, you should know the only reason that's on the kick drum is because he couldn't control his foot. Like, and finally
it was like spazzing out. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Garden City Blues, I finally found a latter day one. It's bump, bump, bump,
yeah,
bump, 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 or whatever.
Right.
And
right.
I played it for him. I'm like, that's how he played it later. He's like, oh, okay. And then I was like, just be yourself. And then once he heard me say that, I think he's like, okay, I have license to do whatever I want.
Sure. Which that's huge for a player. And
yeah.
Cause Michael's, he's one of those people that, I mean, their drummers are like, oh, they're technically accomplished.
Yeah.
They're doing the thing,
yeah,
but they don't have a voice. He definitely had a voice with the drums.
Yeah, he was a musician. The thing those guys have in common, him, Michael, and Jeff, is that they're both really soulful people, and they're really artistic people that happen to play the drums. And then, and they both are really heavy. Like, they're heavy drummers. Like, Jeff plays quiet and it's heavy, and Michael was like that too. So they have that in common. So it's not as hard for him as it would be for like some jazz guy to do it or something.
Right. It's not ill-fitting or anything. It's just it's always kind of,
it's going to be different.
But it's always kind of weird to put someone else's clothes on first time.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah. And then when it's someone that, like, you know, everyone's going to be like, all right, what is he doing? Is he doing the thing? You know, at every moment, it's like, okay. Yeah. He's got to kind of let go a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, I think about when Paho was playing with Gang of Four, of just being like,
yes,
at his dock, and I was like, yeah, I feel like, you know, every guitarist in the crowd is going to be watching your every move.
That's a good comparison, because
he did his own thing with it.
I wouldn't have thought that someone could do that great of a job of playing that stuff besides Andy Gill, and Dave was incredible, and he sounded like him, kind of. I mean, he did have the same bracing sound, but he played his own stuff, and it was really awesome.
It was still uniquely him, even though it served what people wanted to hear for them songs, which is, I mean, that's a crazy balance. You know, another example, Jared Warren playing with Unwound.
Right.
You know, it's like Warren is like one of a kind, and
it's
like, that's another impossible mission, but it's no. Yeah. I mean, there's no one else that could do it. Like, he's perfect at it, and it's not because it's a direct him imitating Vern. It's it works. But again, it was a weird balance beam, especially when people care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a band that, you know, like, whatever, it's like, I don't know. Like, the drummer for Candlebox is probably not as beloved as Michael Dahlquist.
Maybe not quite as important, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't pick a Candlebox song out of a lineup, by the way, but that was a funny word to say. Yeah. You know, and no diss to that guy, but just when it's someone that there's an attachment to, whether the listener knew the person or not.
Yeah.
And it brings a certain weight and heaviness an attention to detail in the listenership that it becomes intrinsic to what you think of with the band. That's hard.
Yeah, totally. Well, and his personality was so, I mean, he taught me and Andy how to be regular human beings around people just by being himself.
Cause really?
He was so garrulous and, well, garrulous is slightly pejorative. He was so friendly and open with people, and he made friends and picked up women wherever he went. Like, he was a very hill fellow, well-met kind of guy. And we were not like that at all. We were like wolf people from Montana, you know. So we learned from him. We're like, oh, he just goes up and talks to these people, you know, it's totally fine or whatever.
Yeah.
And
not overthinking it at all.
No, and we didn't even overthink it. We were just kind of like, bleh. But yeah, so there's that aspect to it. But again, like, there are going to be a lot of people at these shows, like Seth Pomeroy, who made that movie about us,
yeah,
Couldn't Wait, which is awesome. He never saw the band ever.
Really?
Yeah, because he was too young, you know. So
sure,
we just quit playing 20 years ago. So it's going to be interesting for a lot of people that won't know any better. Is what I'm trying to say.
The fact that you just said it's been 20 years ago is.
Yeah, 30 real years since Joel quit, or more than that, and then 20 years since. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, a bummer.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But then, yeah, there's a whole crop of people that never got to see the band play at all ever,
mm-hmm.
and that's huge, and that's great to be able to provide that experience for people. You know, that's a huge thing. What do you do for? Did you ever work out ahead of time about what songs you wanted to play? I mean, are you trying to keep a lid on that? I don't want to like blow your
No, head. we had a big list, and we didn't end up really cutting anything, I don't think. There are some that we sort of de-emphasized slightly, but they're still on the list. And I think everything's going to get played once anyway.
Did any of them just not work or anything? Or did any of them
surprisingly.
Really?
They did all. Like even this last practice, one of our friends was like, are you playing blah, blah, or blah, blah, or blah, blah? And Andy and I were like, no, we're not. And Andy's like, we should try them. I'm like, that's kind of hard. And then we just played it, this song, The Third, on Italian Platinum. And we just played it, and it was great. And I was like, I thought it was difficult to do, but it just, like, worked, you know? And really everything sounds pretty good. Like, we have 2 hours of stuff, and I think it all sounds pretty good. We have probably 10 or 11 songs that are evergreen in there. They'll be in every set. But there's a lot of songs.
Yeah. No, that's great, especially for a band that was such a catalog band and has, again, so many songs that...
We feel like we should play it for a while if we're going to do this. We should blow good and wear ourselves out. Yeah.
How did the Gonerfest thing come about?
Well, that was the first when we were talking about doing this. We had no idea. I didn't know if like 100 people would come. We really didn't know. So I was like, well, we should try to get a linchpin thing that'll at least pay some expenses. Mm-hmm, and Mint Milo played Gonerfest and I loved it. We played on like a Sunday afternoon or something, and it was still super fun. And I thought the batting average of that thing is super high. Like every band, I saw all these bands like I'd never seen before, like Tyvek and Ibex Clone and Negative Approach play. They were super great. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of bands. And the only thing they had in common was they all kicked ass. So it was like, if we could get in there, if they were interested, then that would be a good linchpin thing. And that would tell us, okay, you can book Chicago. And whatever happens, you can go down to Memphis and make enough money to pay for flying everybody here to practice.
You're not going
to
take a loss on it. It's like weird, like...
Yeah, exactly. We didn't want it to be this pathetic, like, oh, those... okay. You know, so anyway, they did it. Gonerfest did it. So... Yeah. We're like, all right, let's try to book a show in Chicago. And we did that, and it sold out in like an hour. And but we didn't know how big to go. And one place in town, we wanted to play one of their big rooms. And they're like, how about this 150 cap? And I'm like, no, if that's all we can do, I'm not interested.
Yeah, but for this level of effort, come on. Yeah, Jesus Christ.
It's just too much work, you know?
Yeah.
So not like I love playing small shows, but not when you're having to fly people here from Canada and Boston to practice.
Yeah.
So anyway, the first show sold out real fast. Second show sold out real fast. And then the other shows are, you know, have gone great so far. So yeah, I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, that's exciting. And it's, again, with so many surprises all the time, most of them bad. It's nice to have a nice surprise. Yeah. Is how I would characterize it.
Where yeah, it's a weird time. So I think a lot about, someone was talking about teachers they had in high school and Blue Sky the other day, and I remembered these two science teachers I had who'd both been in Vietnam, and they were both completely disillusioned. Like, they had no interest in anything patriotic or anything. Right. You know, they didn't think this country was special. And I think about those guys. It was funny they came up, because I think about those people and some other people I knew like that a lot. There have been things equally as bad that have happened in the history of our country so far. You know, I hope we don't tip over into record-setting horribleness. But
yeah, I mean,
all out in the open, which is one weird thing about it.
Probably a larger topic than we're going to be able to sort out in the course of this program, but I think so. Heartily agree with you. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So are you doing this as a let's just like wait and see kind of situation?
Yeah, I think so. It has to be fun. And if it's not fun, then we're not interested. But we have a few things in the works. What's today? Wednesday. I think Friday we'll announce a few shows, not any place people might expect.
Really?
Okay. But south of here. We got offered one linchpin thing, and we're going to do a couple shows around that. And then there's a chance that we'll end up out east. There were a lot of people interested next spring. So we're working on that. We'll see. We want to see how this goes, you know. Maybe we'll get in the van and we'll be like, oh, PTSD or whatever.
Right. Maybe it's going to be the wrong kind of nostalgia. You're like, oh, yeah, you annoyed the living hell out of me. I forgot. Yeah,
that's exactly why Joel hated being in this band, because we suck. Yeah.
Right. No, but I think that that's so, I think that's the best way to do it, right? You keep those expectations grounded. Yeah. Low is not correct, but grounded is the phrase that I would use.
I mean, I admire it when bands come back and they really just become a band again, and they whatever the shiny nostalgia thing or whatever comes off. Like Burma made a bunch of records, perfect, way more after that, you know. And
they stuck around longer as the reunion than they were.
I like that. I don't know if I would have the juice to do that, but I thought that was cool. You know, they're just like, oh, we're a band again, you know, no big deal. Just like always. Or Wire when they came back. Same thing.
Another great example. And some of those, I mean, God, what is it? Send. That's like up there with the first three for me.
Yeah, Red Bark Tree, really great record.
Change Becomes Us, all those old songs that were just like, this is great. Yeah. Like I was listening. All what's the good one? Was Red Bark Tree the one that was like a couple years ago? I can't remember. Whatever that last one was great.
I don't
too.
Know. I've had a hard time keeping up because he put out some records.
Dude, same.
Yeah. I do own them all.
But I do like them. It's good. It's a good thing to, oh, there's too many great Wire records. Yeah. Oh, no. Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just cool to me that they had these canonical three records, and then it's like, and then, you know, good ones after that too. And then they're just like, oh, let's just make a whole shitload more records.
Yeah.
Burma did the same thing. You know, they had a couple, absolute standby. They had the EP and the album, absolute rock solid. And then they just went and just put out a whole bunch of records.
A bunch more.
Yeah.
Like, and some of those are really cool too. And if you just heard them and you didn't know what the band was, you'd be like,
you walked into
badass.
A bar and saw that band, you'd be like, what?
Yeah, what is this?
Yeah,
totally. Amazing.
Yeah,
and I never got to see him. You know, I mean, I got to see him when they came back. Both those bands.
Same.
But it was like, I was too busy being like a child when they were doing.
Same,
that stuff.
And I think some of that is part of why we didn't do this for other people, but a nice effect of it is, like I was talking about earlier, there are going to be a lot of people that see us play, I think, over the next little bit who didn't ever get to see it. And I think we wouldn't do it if it wasn't representative, and I think it will be representative of just the way the band's always sounded. So I think it'll be, it's not going to be like, oh, here's a review of the, you know, ye old 90s times when bands were like this. It's going to be alive, I think, you know.
Well, and it's not, the way it's being presented isn't like, here's this revival of this thing. It's alt universe continuation, I think it's how it was phrased, or something along those lines, right? And I was like, oh, that's cool. That's a good way to describe that. Because, and again, because you have to serve the communication for people that are the diehards and maybe people for the casual fans who are like, oh, yeah, what was that band all about? I remember hearing them. That was pretty good.
Sure, yeah.
And it's almost impossible to disseminate any information effectively these days. so it's yeah. kind of a minor miracle if anybody pays any attention to anything at all, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I love that you've done in this manner. It's a very kind of slow burn, you know, and kind of which allows people to they get to be the town crier about it, right? Then that's fun, where you're like, oh my god, did you hear? That's it's amazing. Yeah, you know, right. Something to be said for that, rather than like, here's the press release that gets blasted out on all the usual suspects and blah 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 blah.
Yeah,
blah,
I mean, and we're from a different. This is an old man thing, but we're from a different era, right? We really are. Like, it was different. You know, you would flyer for shows or whatever, but that would be about it. And nowadays, you got to have fucking likes and followers and everyone, you have to be posting content all the time and stuff. And I don't envy the kids.
Yeah,
in that respect, a lot of the kids are great and doing great stuff and cool stuff, but I'm glad I don't have to do that kind of stuff.
But it's part of the package now, which is crazy. It is.
Yeah, hype and pumping yourself up and stuff. And that was kind of, it was almost, well, you know, selling out was a thing.
I talk about on the show all the time that selling out itself is an outmoded concept.
It is,
which is insane. I mean, people look at like, well, how else would anyone hear your music? And it's like,
yeah,
well, you got me there. I don't know, Adbusters. You know,
yeah.
Like, what do you say?
A lot of these kid bands that I like are this band Squirrel Flower that's good, or I talk about these guys a little bit in the book, the Lifeguard guys.
Oh, they were great. Yeah, I saw them with Junior 44.
Yeah, and Sharp Pins. Like, those, that stuff is really good, and they're clearly not interested in hyping. Like, they just play, you know?
Right, and that does exist. Yeah.
It totally exists, and it's just it's absolutely 100% as genuine as anybody like us was doing back in the olden days.
Well, it just goes to show you that there's always ways to forge your own path.
Yeah.
And that's something that's encouraging to me, because it feels like there's always a way to forge your own path. Asterisk, as long as it's within these corporate walled gardens.
Yeah, you know? Right.
Or it's like, okay.
But, well, there's hardly even a music industry now, so maybe that helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's something, you know, when you think about, you know, this, the time that's passed, Lifestyle's 25 years old, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I remember when that came out.
Yeah, me too.
it feels like yesterday. I have meant to have you on when there was do records have birthdays? Sure. Birthday for Firewater, for Developer, since we did Firewater.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Blue Blood, forgot both times. My bad.
Yeah.
But there is something kind of cool to... You know, some people like Ian MacKay are just dead set against any kind of backwards gazing at all creatively. But when you can revisit the music at a later period, when you're the person you are now, and see what you can kind of pick up from it, even as a listener.
Yeah.
But as when you've made the music, even, you know, in some cases, like, oh, I can hear this as music now, rather than the 3 days we had to like do everything to record it.
Totally. Yeah.
Has there been... You know, with I assume you're listening back to some of the songs and stuff. Has there been any kind of epiphanies with the retrospection that kind of comes with putting something like this?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some stuff, and I'm just like, what's even happening there? And then once you start figuring it out, your hand just goes zoop, 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 and you're like, oh, it's like the blues, you know? It's like that's a lick, and I do that all the time, and that's the thing that I did, and then it went to the other thing that I do, you know? Because that's what sounds good to me, and it still sounds good to me. You know? Right. I just hadn't done that particular thing for a while. And I remember when a while ago, when Italian Platinum got reissued, and I think that's one of our few best records probably. And but when we made it, we just made it. We were touring and stuff. We were all working, and I liked it, but I didn't stop to think about it. You just keep going.
Yeah.
And I listened to Test Price and I was like, oh my, this record kicks ass.
It kind of rips. It's like the secret ripper. Yeah. Like,
I was just like, what the? I didn't even know we kicked that much ass, you know?
Well, so. And I specifically remember, not that you need to care about this, but like when it came out, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's a little different.
Yeah.
Like, but not in the way that developer was to Firewater, but like I was like, oh, that's a little different, interesting. Like right. I didn't love it at first, but I was like, oh, but it's kind of it's neat sounding. Let me, and then I was like, oh wow, actually this might be their best record somehow. Like it's yeah. crazy. Like is this like their 12th record or something? What is this? This that's wild.
Yeah.
And that's always something that, you know, I always said with the band is that like, you know, they're all interesting records, but it's a rare case where. Like there's the lexicon of, oh, the band's first record is the best, and the second one is the follow up that's like not as good because they didn't have as much time, blah blah blah. This narrative that's written, it's like no, not at all. With Silkworm, it's like no, they're just kind of now they're going over here, now they're over there, and now they're over here.
Yeah, we never put anything out; just put it out is the main thing. I think we always had to feel. We never jumped the gun ever putting stuff out. We just kind of always we had to always feel like oh there. It's finished, you know.
What, and I invoked developer before, so I guess we got to talk about it. That's the one where it's like, I mean, I actually really dig that record, but that's a weird record, man.
It's very weird. And at the time, I don't know. We knew this was a byproduct of us doing what we did.
Yeah.
We knew we were probably going to get dropped, I think. But we still took, we had a bunch of songs that were superficially catchy or whatever, but I didn't love it. And then we kept cutting and cutting and cutting. And then we got to what it is. And we're like, well, that's awesome. It's really odd. But, it, you know, that's just the way it is. And then we gave it to Matador. Like, here you go. We took those five songs that are sort of catchy off. And that was the right thing to do. A lot of those songs, a couple of them got lost. But most of them got done better later, you know.
It maybe wasn't the right time for them or something. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But you still have, I mean, like, Never Met a Man I Didn't Like, I think it's like wild catchy.
No, it's great.
But it's, you know, it's.
That's it. That's the one song.
That's about it. But I just remember being like, wow, it's like moody. It's like this is a moody record. Mm-hmm. And but then I think back of like, you know, bands like The Cure, right? Where it's like, oh no, like put out this record, these songs just go and go and go, and that's what they do. And if you don't like it, go pound sand. Okay. Well,
yeah, it's
great.
Shit. It's a very loose, weird record. There's a lot of weird playing on it.
Yeah.
And it goes all over the place and I think it's awesome. That's one that we did, you know, when it got reissued and I got the test pressings, I listened to it. I was like, God, this record is so great. And I think the thing I like about it is it seems very pure. This book that just came out about us.
I saw that. Called? Yeah.
What's it called? Lay It Down in Full View. And it's really, really good. There's so much great writing in it. And one of the things in it that isn't as good as some of the great writing, but still pretty funny at least, is this interview that Andy and I did. Matt Cadane, our buddy from Bedhead and stuff, interviewed us, and who also played in the band. But something I said in there was, I felt like Firewater, which is great, had ambition. You know, there's some creative ambition in it. Not commercial, obviously, maybe, but we had an idea that we could go big, you know, and all double albums are kind of ambitious in some way.
Almost definitionally, yes. Yeah.
But developer is not ambitious. It's just us just doing our thing and not thinking about anything, not anybody else. We're not thinking about any goals or anything. We're just doing it. And that comes through in the whole record, I think. And the songs that didn't make it are a little bit ambitious, so they got cut.
Which don't fit, right? And then there is that thing where and you it takes a while some sort of band to recognize this, right? Yeah, this is great and it doesn't fit with these.
Yeah, it kicks ass, but it kind of kicks too much ass or something, you know.
Yeah, and there's it isn't even always completely definable as to why that reason might be, but like you just know, you're like, that doesn't fit. That's
we had a thing I think maybe I talked about this in that interview too. I only have so many stories, but
probably. There,
it was Italian Platinum. The first song is called "I Hope You Don't Survive." It's a really great song, kicks ass.
Good but, opener. Good.
We mixed it, and it sounded great. And Andy worked really hard on the vocal; and it sounded great. And then I was like, you know, what if the guitars and the bass were a little louder? The guitar and the bass. And so Steve's like, "Well, we printed that one, so let's try it." And so he jacked them up. And then afterwards, I turned back to Andy, and I'm like, what do you think? And he looked seriously bummed out, and I'm like, you don't like it? And he's like, no, it sounds worse, but it's better. So he's like, I guess it kind of fucks up my vocal, but
yeah.
You know, we have to use that one because that one really crushes.
Well, yeah, because it makes it more like he's like fighting to be heard almost a little more. But that it's kind of cool though.
No, it's better.
It totally works.
Yeah, but it would like that's a good example of the kind of decision making that we did as a band. Yeah. You know?
No, I love that, and that's something where it, you know, unique decision making that may seem inscrutable or impossible to understand in some way, shape, or form. That ended up, you know, I think Blue Blood's a great record too, and that one was like maligned, at the time, which is like funny to me. It's like, really? Okay.
Yeah, I guess maybe it was. I don't know. I can't remember. I remember I got a 2-star, 2-thing review in Pitchfork, which was pretty cool. Wow. But that's not, it's gone now, which kind of bums me out.
That's,
I always said 7 is the worst on Pitchfork. And if you can get a really low or really high score, that's great.
But, yeah, but 7's like, we just, it's square right down the middle. Yeah.
It's too boring. Like, you didn't make them feel anything. Yeah, exactly.
Which is, actually, yeah, that is worse. Now that you think about
it. Not that I cared what I got from Pitchfork, but you know. Yeah, ideally, you'd want to get a 2 or 9 or something like that.
And now all those reviews will be lost in time, like Tears in the Rain.
Yes, which is okay. That's all right.
But I think that's one that aged well. Like, that was when it came out, I remember it feeling people felt that was ill-fitting as a follow-up, which, like, from developer? I mean, you don't know what to, like, what would you follow it up with?
Yeah.
But I think it aged well.
Yeah, it's a little more modest record, and there are some songs on it, like we're playing Ritz Dance. It sounds enormous.
Oh,
and it does not sound enormous on the record. It sounds cool on the record, but it doesn't sound huge. And there's a song we're not playing, not to give away too much, called Said It Too Late, that could have sounded bigger if we'd recorded it with Steve. You know, Steve just helped us mix it.
Yeah.
We recorded the whole thing in a basement, and I think
it's really,
I like it a lot, that record, but it's not typical, you know, or whatever our typical record was, which I don't know if that existed really.
Which, yeah. And that's the first record that kind of had, to me, had a little bit more twang, in a few places. Right.
Probably.
And,
yeah.
And that was something that you hear more of later, but it was interesting. Like, at the time I was like, huh. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then at the same time, I was, you know, kind of exploring all this other stuff that's like, oh, okay, well, like, there's these other Neil Young records I never heard. They're like, okay, this is, you know, this is really cool. There's a precedent for all of this.
Yeah.
I was very country averse until I worked at a record store.
Oh, really?
Because I only heard the worst country music you ever heard growing up in the Central Valley, where it's like,
well, there's a lot of bad country music.
And then I was like, then I was hearing all this like great stuff where I was like, oh God, this is all amazing. Like, but I had to work at a record store to hear it because it wasn't the age of, you know, the streaming services and walled gardens. So I actually had to have CDs to throw on. And yeah, is that better or worse? I don't know. I was wrong about a whole bunch of stuff for years. What does that tell you? Okay. And then Lifestyle, which is, you know, I love that one. That's great. That's the one when I first saw you guys, the first time I saw you guys, it was, I want to say it was in Victoria with Shellac.
Oh yeah.
Which was great.
That show?
Yeah, that was, there's cobblestones everywhere. I remember that very distinctly with the cobblestones.
It's in this weird bar that had a lot of brass in it. That's all
it
I
did.
Remember.
And the X was playing on the stereo. And it was the first time I heard the X too. I remember all these like weird details.
Yeah.
And I uncharacteristically talked to Andy about his overdrive pedal too. Cause I was like, wow, that's a really great overdrive sound. And I'm not ever that guy. Like, I do like gear, but I'm never, ever, ever, ever that guy. And I realized, like, what is that? That's amazing sounding. And at the time, it's like, I knew you guys, but I wasn't like a super fan yet. I was just like, oh, yeah, I got a couple of those records. Yeah, they're good.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, that was the first time I'd ever heard Garden City Blues.
Oh, okay.
And I think you may have opened with it.
Yeah, we did that pretty often.
And I was like, hey, what's, and so the other thing I asked that wasn't gear related, I was like, hey, what's that one? Like, what's, mm-hmm. which one is that? I don't have that one. You're like, oh, mm-hmm. it's on this album in the West. I'm like, oh, okay. And that's where I was like, oh, there's records that I don't have. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's like led me down that road. But it was such a weird situation to be like, you're in this freaking fairy tale kingdom this weird bar. It did have a lot of brass, by the way, like so much brass. And I was just there with my friend.
Maybe Ferns too, even.
Yeah, I was, and it's just like, yeah. Do they know what's going to happen here? Like, are they aware that, like, we were just like, me and my friend Leela, RIP, we're just like so confused, but like amused at the same time. Like, are they going to shut it down? Like, are they going to? Are we going to see a mounted policeman? Are we going to? You know. But it, in a way, it was sort of perfect. I also remember too, we didn't have any money either, and I remember like standing outside the club, and we were just sort of like trying to figure out what we could do, and saw Michael come out of the club, made direct eye contact with us, smiled. Kind of jumped up like a cartoon character and spun around in one move and like walked the other way. Like theatrically. And I was like, that's the most badass thing I've ever seen.
That's amazing.
Which is a story that I literally forgot about that until like 30 seconds ago.
That's really great. I can see that.
Because he was that kind of guy. There was a sort of like this big theatrical is like kind of the wrong big presence.
Got the he was a super goofball. I mean, to call him a goofball, it's kind of like we would talk about. We talked a lot about how loud he was as a drummer, super loud drummer.
Yeah.
But I've realized in the last few months of talking about this stuff with people, that's really reductive. Like he was a musician, you know, for
he's
sure.
He's a musical drummer.
And an artist. Yeah. Like he could paint, he could write, he could draw, he could do everything. So he was a super, super, super interesting dude. Like really, really widely competent at so many different things and so interested. And I still, like, to this day, there'll be things that he told me about that I haven't gotten to yet, you know. But, like, many years, 10 years after he died, I finally read Sight Read by Cormac McCarthy. And
oh, really? Wow.
And I was like, oh, okay, that's why he wanted me to read it. I get it, you know. I read Blood Meridian first, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, let's just start with the most, like, oh, my God, that one's
or, like, brutal. He would talk about Akewood for a long time.
Sure, yeah.
And I was like, whatever, comics. And then I started reading. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I read Kathy. I know comics.
Yeah, yeah, so he was just kind of tied into stuff, and he just said so many, you know, Joseph Beuys, he was really into Joseph Beuys for a long time, and mysticism and stuff. He went to Naropa and studied with Allen Ginsberg and people like that. So, yeah. Yeah, he was also just a dingbat, you know.
He was also one of the first people to do, like, online tour journals, too. And yes. I remember distinctly, because I was an avid fan of them. Like, I read them all, and it was Rose from Poster Children.
Yeah.
Michael on the Silkworm site, and Watt. And my Watt's still doing them, which I love.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being someone that, like, at the time, I was kind of just just barely getting it together. But getting it together to start, like, living that life myself, it was fascinating to me. Like, I want to know everything. Because, again, you didn't have this instant information where, like, hey, here we are. We're backstage. We're sound checking. Now we're doing this. Now we're doing that. None of that was around. So just getting any of that information at all for bands I cared about was very difficult, unless, like, it was, like, literally written up in a zine. Zine! Which I was an avid fan of as well. But the fact that, like, you can read them on the computer?
Yeah.
Amazing!
Yeah, we read voraciously in Missoula, me and Andy, for sure, read Steve's tour journals from Big Black and stuff that were in Forced Exposure.
Yeah.
That were just, like, hilarious and, you know, super crude and great. And, then we would read, and then there'd be like Sonic Youth tour journals in there and stuff. And like, we love Sonic Youth. So
yeah, of course
we just ate all that shit up. And it really did. Even, you know, later, I think I felt like if I were to look back, I would have realized, oh, they really did spell it out. Like, this is pretty much what it's like. It's not, you know, there's nothing glamorous about it, but we weren't looking for that. We were looking for this kind of like real experience of grinding it out and like just playing as much as you possibly could. And that was the goal for, you know, any band that we liked that did that kind of stuff. It would be talking about the shows in this kind of like, I don't know, like sort of an emotional but really kind of metaphysical way. Like it felt like I was sleeping while I was playing, and you know, like I was sort of, you know, they talk about like these out of body kind of experiences, and then you start to be able to do that and you're like, oh yeah, this is where it's at. This is what you do.
Right. You're not the mechanical parts of the body. You're not the constituent parts of the player.
Like, we made $2,000 and we stayed at a Holiday Inn. The coffee was great. The breakfast sucked. You know, none of that stuff mattered. It was about, you know, I literally, Michael told us one thing in one of his tour journals about playing Don't Make Plans This Friday, which is great. And we would regularly play it really long because it would go off. And, but Michael and I would too. And that was in the trio time, we could be really loose with it. So, but he talked about watching me play, and I had my eyes closed the whole time, and I ended up like in a corner or something. I didn't even know
where you didn't know where you were. Yeah, sure.
I didn't know anything. And he was like, he said eventually he just closed his eyes and played, and then he felt like he had been asleep, and he'd woken up, and he's like, what's happening? I don't know where I am. You know, and that's if that could happen every song, that would be amazing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And
year.
You know, and some nights you're just, you know, punching the clock and all right, we're going to do the thing that we do. Okay. You know,
yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's bad.
We had so few shows that felt, we really had so few shows that felt, and I don't think this is rose colored glasses because I remember how gritty some of them were, but they never really felt pro forma. It was always the playing part was always up here. And then maybe the bar was down here. You know, the place you played or like the people. We played a place in West Virginia one time and there were a bunch of white power dudes came stomping in their fucking suspenders and Joel couldn't play because he broke his guitar. And that was the first show we'd ever played as a trio.
Oh,
and,
man.
That was the beginning of the end maybe. But we played great and I remember it feeling great. And then you'd open your eyes and you see these like skinheads, you know, stomping around. Not dancing or whatever.
No, of course not.
Trying to pick a fight with someone, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the art is there, but maybe the place that the art is happening at is not the right place for it or whatever.
It's funny, though. I've talked to people who've seen us who will be like, I saw you play in Ypsilanti in front of five people, with five people. It was really great. And I'll be like, oh. So it meant something to somebody, you know. A few of the best shows I've ever seen have been with five other people.
Yeah, we're just like, I can't believe that like this is happening. There's like nobody here.
I saw Jonathan Gott's band, and Jonathan's does pretty well now. But
yeah,
his band played. We played. Mint Mile played as a duo with them at Double Door, but it was actually the Triple Door, which was the basement. Like hallway in between the bathrooms at the Double Door. We played down there and then they didn't need a PA or whatever. And they're like, fuck this. And they played in the beer storage room, which was very small. And there were five or eight of us there and it was mind blowing.
Sure.
So great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll never see anything like that again. You know?
Well, yeah. And those are the kind of moments that, you know, transcendental moments don't always necessarily mean,
no.
Ideal from the perspective of cinematic.
No, it's not important. Yeah, it can happen. It happens in practice.
Sure.
You know, I love practice and regularly these worm practices, super long ones, as much of a grind as that sounds, it'll be like, whoa, I don't even know what we did there, but that was great.
Right, yeah.
I hope that happens again sometime.
Yeah, that's cool. That's encouraging as well. And also, I mean, getting back to the tour journal thing,
yeah.
You know, if you haven't lived that life yet, even just being like, oh, yeah, you know, we sound checked and the guy was like really weird and off putting, you know.
Yeah.
That's fun to hear about because it makes you think like you're there. Like it gives you and also mentally prepares you for not all being wine and roses, too.
Oh, yeah. You're going to get yelled at. Yeah. A lot.
Yeah.
If you're any good, you're going to get yelled at.
Playing too loud. Yeah, exactly. And Michael's had a great weight of doing all of it and putting it together in a way that was engaging and informative. Right. And that was really cool.
Well, he just loved life in a way that,
and that came across.
And he's more nihilistic than he is ever than me probably. I was a little bit more like, even keel, and I wouldn't get as excited about stuff, but Michael would get excited about the dumbest shit, you know, not in a mindless way, but he was just an enthusiast, you know. He liked anything that tasted good or looked good or sounded good or whatever. So, yeah.
He was the
right person to do that for sure.
Absolutely. I can't believe that the Libertine re-release was 11 years ago. I just looked at and I was like, no. Really? No. Can't be.
Yeah.
God damn, man. How is it coming back to that record? come back to Libertine?
It was revelatory. And, you know, that might have fed into a little bit to this whole thing because I always thought that record was one of the best ones. Well, for sure, it was a higher watermark of the four of us. And then I thought it measured up with everything we ever did. But I hadn't listened to it that intently for years. And then we remastered it. And I listened to it before we remastered it. And I thought, man, this record is awesome. And then Matt Barnhart, who plays bass in Mint Mile and is mastering engineer and just general guy, music guy, great guy. Super talented dude. But he and I mastered it. Or no, did Bob mastered that one. Yeah, I mastered that with Bob. And then it had the master notes from Abbey Road, and we just copied it, except we left the low end in. That was the main, which made a huge difference because it should have been a double album, and it wasn't.
Right.
So spread out over two records, it has really good, lush low end on it. And,
yeah, because there's an A, B, C, D. It ends with the cigarette lighters, but it's No, this is coming back to me now.
And
it's on thicker vinyl, too. It's the 45 RPM thick vinyl.
Yeah, and I just thought, as I have so many times revisiting this stuff, like, how do we do that? I don't really know. You know, I don't really know how. I don't know how Joel wrote any of his songs on there. I don't know how I did. I remember writing Couldn't You Wait, but I don't remember writing anything else. I don't know how it happened. I don't know how I decided. There's some really weird playing on it, and I don't know how why I did that.
It's kind of unorthodox. Yeah. Well, even for Silkworm.
Yeah. There's just some weird bass stuff that's like, I've mentioned this before. I think there's a thing where I played two notes and the chord is six chords and they don't really go exactly, but I just did it. And it sounds really cool. I think maybe it was a Kim Gordon thing because she would do that a lot. She would play weird chromatic stuff underneath while the guitars weren't really like playing regular chords either. So you could kind of do whatever, but it would make this real weird wobbly thing happen. And then when she locked in with them, it was like, honk.
Yeah, so the tension release thing.
I hadn't thought of this, but I think I got that from her, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe from Tina Weymouth, who did that in Talking Heads, too. Like, once in a lifetime, she plays the same thing all the way through the whole song. Never changes. Never. And the rest of the song goes into
around, things. Up, this way, that way.
Or Dreams by Fleetwood Mac, same thing. So those are my two
things
that come to mind. But anyway, I think that's where I probably got it from. But it's I don't know. It doesn't make sense really in a musical way. It just makes sense aurally, like the mood of it is right, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that on that album. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, I can't believe it was, 5 years ago for In the West. That doesn't seem right, too. But that also seems like 5 weeks ago, same time.
Yeah.
And that's a one that I was very familiar with, but had a, I had like a used CD or something, right? Like it was to serve the purpose of being music I could listen to.
Yeah.
And to see like the, like even the expanded artwork, right? Which was sort of revamped in that same way.
Yes. Yeah, Mike Hoffman did the art, redid it, kind of reimagined it.
Arch of Loaf did Michael that too.
Stepbrother, yeah.
The Arch of Loaf did that with a few of their records, and it was like two great.
There was
effects.
No art, and there was no master tapes. We had to remix it, which turned out to be fine because the remix was really good. I thought
that all the mixes, because there's so much. It's a very dense record, right? Yes. So it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, there's stuff. It's like, huh, I didn't even know that was there.
Yeah, and we made it in 3.5 days, so. The mix was not, you know, I mean, it was good on the original one, but it wasn't the way this one was. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to get some attrition when you're working that quickly.
I wouldn't want to remix Firewater. So I don't think we'll do that. You know, that one was bright, I think, when we finished it. So
I don't think it really could be improved on. I mean, good. It's just one of those rare ones where that's
really
everything on there is correct.
I wouldn't want to redo any of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just
the
way they are.
Yeah, which is, and again, even when you're making decisions, like, you know, like you mentioned, the Italian Platinum thing of like, okay, it's going to sound like the vocals, it'll struggle a little more, but it does kind of kick ass, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
And there's something about, and I should also give a shout out to friend of the show, John Solomon, of course, Comedy Minus One, who's been so diligent about putting all these reissues together. Former guest of the show many years ago, but I did have him on the show one time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he's a perfect example of the kind of guy that Silkworm engendered as a fan, right? It's just people mm-hmm. that like, oh, they just quietly do cool shit.
Yes.
Or maybe not so quietly in some cases, but
yeah,
you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, the fact that Injun Kid was sort of like one of your buddy bands
yep.
in Seattle. And I always call that the Gold Rush, and you would be after the Gold Rush.
Yep. Yeah.
See what I did there? Very clever. Yeah. Anyway. but Injun Kid was something where, I mean, I feel like there's, you know, bonded in blood around that time to a certain yeah. degree. And like, yeah. look him now, like what is up to, which kind of goes back to, I think we talked about one of the times that you came on, maybe it was when you were in the studio playing with Sun.
Uh-huh.
And like what, how different that is and like how those shows are.
Yes.
You know, here's 1,000 years of time. Now you're going to play your second note.
Right? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Those guys are very, I mean, ideologically, we're exactly the same when it yeah. comes to music. Me and Greg, or Steven, for that matter, all three of us, we all were completely 100% on the same wavelength. And it's not a unique way to look at things. But, you know, they're motivated 100% by wanting to create an environment when they play, you know. And they do it really specifically. And overtly with, you know, the way light and fog is used with them, and who does that stuff,
the atmosphere of it. Yeah.
She's
yeah.
like a master and yeah. she's a really essential part of the whole thing. But, you know, even less, I never really thought about it, but really that's always what I want to try to do playing music is just whatever space it's in, change it so that it's not about the room or anymore. It's about whatever what you filled it with, you know.
You're terraforming a planet.
Yeah, ideally. I mean, ideally you create a new thing and people live mm-hmm. in that for a while. In any show I've ever seen that I thought was great, the band did that somehow, or the person did that.
Well, and it makes sense. I mean, because I saw Silkworm over the years, like, you know, Bottom of the Hill, like the Fillmore. Like, yeah. these are like very different venues with very different size crowds and
right.
Room to move in some cases. And mm-hmm. it always did what it does with any band where it almost could be anywhere to a certain yeah. degree. Because it's where you're in the space of the interaction between the audience and the performers.
Yeah, I think it was Rolling Burroughs wrote this thing about Led Zeppelin one time that was really good. And it was interesting to me because so many critics miss that kind of music completely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Zeppelin even, or Sabbath for sure, like they just didn't understand it at the time, and they'll pay lip service to it later, but they don't get it in the moment because they can't, I don't know, psychoanalyze the lyrics or whatever. But he talked about how he totally nailed it, very short thing in the whole review, and he talks about rock concerts are a transmutation of energy between the performer and the audience. Like it's an exchange yeah. and it's a loop and it builds and builds and it grows into something that doesn't, it can't just come from the people on stage or the people watching. It has to be this like regeneration of energy, you know, building up. And ideally that's what happens, you know?
Yeah. It's ineffable. There's something about yes. it that even by the act of trying to quantify it, you can't,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, but you and know,
everyone has to kind of, you know, I never think about the audience when I'm playing ever. but you can feel it. If there's feedback from them, you mm-hmm. can feel it, whether it's positive yeah. or negative. And as long as you can take that in and do something with it or not absorb it, I guess, if you're really intent on doing your thing,
yeah.
then it's good no matter what it is, you know. That's the way I've always felt about it anyway.
Yeah, and it's something that you see across all genres, across all types of performers.
Yes, yeah, totally.
And that's, there's something, and I say that as someone that, you know, look, I'm a secular humanist. I'm very grounded. You know, I'm not like a new age guy or anything along those lines. But it's pretty mm-hmm. undeniable that, okay, especially if you've ever felt it, where you're like, oh, yeah, this is beyond, like this is channeling something. This is coming from somewhere different somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just the combination of the mindset of everyone that's there,
Ideally, that probably has something to do with the art and what's happening at those moments in time, but it takes you somewhere different.
Yeah, and that's what, like with Sun, that's an ultimate thing with them. I think every show has to do that for them or they don't feel like it worked, you know?
Yeah.
And when it works, it's really, well, on stage, it's going to work.
Right, sure. Yeah.
100% of the time. But you really have to be willing to submit and not in a like you're being overpowered way, but you have to be willing to like live there and not expect the clock to work or whatever anymore. You know, that's a real extreme example, but I think any good band, that's what it's like. And like with us, part of that was always volume for us. I felt like we can't really do this quiet. I mean, we can have quiet parts, but we can't really do it quietly. You know, it can't be like the new paradigm of having its tiny little amp. you know, like all the kids have these tiny little amps now.
Oh, yeah, we can't they really do that. Are. Yeah.
We have to, it has to kind of come out and get you. And
man,
you can either leave or you can be there and be part of it. You
know? You're talking to a guy that still tours with 412s and 215s. I get it.
Yeah.
Sometimes my back is like, why do you do this now?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah. That's not a good enough reason not to do it. Yeah, it's because they're heavy. Yeah. But, you know, not every band needs that. A lot of bands don't need that.
Yeah.
And but for us, that's always, it has to kind of come out. And I feel like it's got to grab you by the front of your shirt a little bit.
Yeah, because there's immediacy to it, right? And there's not, mm-hmm. and that's not the same. It's not one size fits all. That's not every music, not every band should be doing that, but there is something to be said for that level of immediacy. So that has, again, that has to be something that you think about when you're revisiting stuff, is that you want it to honor what has come before while also being its own thing.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I was kind of interrogating you about like, well, did it work immediately? Because sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it takes a little bit. Sometimes you got to grind on a little bit, right?
Yeah.
And there's no shame in the game. That's why it's called practice. And you know,
some stuff that was trickier to get done completely, but it always had the kernel of the thing in it. You know, so it was worth beating it up a little bit.
And you knew you'd get there.
Iron it out. Yeah.
That's great. I mean, it's great to have that level of confidence with it and trust.
Yeah.
I mean, there really is a lot about trust, I would imagine.
Uh huh. Now everyone's going to come on Friday, so we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe it'll just be 10 songs. I don't know. We'll see.
Maybe be like, let's cut. let's cut all these. I'm absolutely devastated. I'm not going to be at any of these shows. We already have plans. We're going to be elsewhere.
And yeah, that sucks.
I'm not happy about it.
But. Oh well. Well, you never know. Maybe there'll be more.
If there's others, I would definitely go out of my way to see them. Let's put it that way.
All right, cool.
Tim's great, man. Thanks so much for revisiting all this stuff with me. Like I said, I wanted to go more in depth like a couple times. There's a Mint Mile record I was going to have you on for. I mean,
sure.
Cool. It's literally just me, man. And like sometimes the crack show, and that's all I can say about it. And I thought about it even more so when you were on Deep Tunnel, which is great. Just saw a lovely Deep Tunnel project show in Milwaukee. That was awesome. Love right those on. Guys.
Yeah, that was fun.
Anything else you'd like to share? You mentioned offhandedly that book, which is like, okay, there's a book. Crazy.
Yeah,
literate audience.
I mean, I didn't think the movie would ever get made, and then Seth, he made a very good version of it, and I was like, this is great, and he's like, I'm not happy with them. I recut it, and I'm like, you're insane. And then he recut it, and it was way better. And I don't know, I couldn't have imagined how it could have been better, but I'm not a movie filmmaker. So, you know, people, when people do stuff like that, it's just kind of mind-blowing, and the book thing is even maybe a little more mind-blowing in some ways, because I mean the work was divided up, so it's a bunch of different people, but it's like hundreds of pages, and there's stuff in there that I wouldn't have ever expected anyone to, you know, pick up on, or it's just so flattering, and it's really pretty great, you know, to have people be into your stuff enough, and not just into it, but like really understand it on a really deep level, and you realize, oh, okay, I wasn't just, you know, it didn't matter. I was doing it for myself or whatever, my pals, because we liked it. But to know that other people got out of it exactly what you put into it is pretty strange.
That's something special.
Yeah, it's cool. It's really cool.
It's also a book. It's like, you know.
Yeah, it's going to live forever, right? I mean, I think the records will live. That's the one good thing about LPs is I think they're going to live forever.
Right. So. Yeah, all the bands that don't do physical releases and stuff, when all this stuff goes away, don't say when, not if.
Oh, yeah, it will. Yeah.
You know, it's happening faster than I thought.
There's not enough money being made on that shit.
Nope. It's it will fundamentally change things in a way that we can only imagine in our darkest times.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, that is not a very cheery topic. So, Tim, super stoked for everyone to be able to experience these Silkworm shows. I hope they tell me all about it and take some pictures because I won't be there. And yeah, always a pleasure. Any you still doing the rub?
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm out. So I gotta get some.
Oh, okay. People don't know we're talking about it.
I was looking at the spice rack. I was like, hey, I'm out of that. I'm gonna talk to him this week.
Yeah, no, I still sell it. I'm almost out of bags right now. So it's legal. There's nothing, you know, it's not, we're not talking about narcotics here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't want to get on a list.
The thought never crossed my mind, but that is hilarious and funny. You've probably answered this question before, but I'm gonna ask it to you again.
Yeah.
Why do you do what you do?
I think I feel like it is. I feel like you, when you're making any kind of art from, with no intent other than to create, I think that you're just in touch with this like super long line of human beings, you know, and I think it really taps into what it feels like to be alive. And that's kind of the whole goal of it, I think, is to describe something about being alive. It could be good or bad stuff, but you know, try to do that and not to impress anyone or do anything like that, just to try to, like, it's almost like a diary, only it's not necessarily your life, you know. It's stuff you've seen or heard or felt, or other people have seen or heard or felt that you've heard about, you know. And I just think being part of that line of thought is important, especially now, you know, things are very fragmented now with I mean, you can't even read the newspaper on the internet. You have to subscribe to all this bullshit, you know, and it's like, it's hard. Yeah. Like, again, I know I'm old, but, you know, I feel like just experiencing life as this line that keeps going all the way through to the end of it for you, but even beyond that, I think it's good to be in tune with that. I think doing this stuff, that it makes me aware of that, you know, more than I would be if I just, like, worked and went to sleep and got up and worked.
Tim Midget, thanks so much, man. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks, man.
Take care.
All right.
There he goes. There he goes. Silkworm's back. Wow. You people better report back to me. That's all I got to say, because I'm pretty pissed to have to miss it. That is, there's a Silkworm Instagram account if you were not aware. So if, let's say perhaps if there's other things to be announced, you can find out there. Silkworm.music. I'll put that in the show notes, of course, as with everything else. Huge thank you to Tim and all our listeners. Let's go out on Garden City Blues.
Time is winding down so loudly. Give yourself
All right, that was a little Garden City. Got a little Garden City Blues, everybody, off of In the West. That great reissue that came out 5 years ago. I'd like to give a huge thank you to Tim for being back on the show for a fifth visit. I always love that dude. Love hearing about it. Pretty bummed I'm going to miss these shows, so don't be like Conan Neutron. Go see Silkworm if you're remotely in any of those areas. It's three shows in Chicago, Tolono, Illinois, Loose Cobra, and Gonerfest in Memphis. Go see them. Who knows if it's going to ever happen again? Who knows if we'll all be here tomorrow? Anyway, this has been Protonic Reversal. Thanks very much for listening to it. This show airs usually Thursdays. 8 Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific. Streaming live on YouTube and Twitch. Podcasted later everywhere. Always free. No ads. No sponsors. No kidding. But if you like the show and you want to get some episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal. We'll achieve that goal. Helps keep the lights on in here. Appreciate that. Very much so. Now more than ever. Thanks for people liking and subscribing on your platform of choice. All that helps people discover the show, and it's just a darn nice thing to do. I really do appreciate it. It's awesome. Steve Tulipana from Season of Risk coming up next, and I think Keith Brammer of Decoration's coming on as soon as well. Always a bunch of great stuff on Protonic Reversal. Follow us on all the things if that is your thing. Secret Friends on tour October and November. Come see us if you are around in the places that we're playing. NeutronFriends.bandcamp.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm out of here. Stay safe out there.
Can you hear me now?
And I'll check you later.
Out on Route 128, dark and lonely. I got my radio on. Can you hear me now? Welcome to my top 10. I'd like to thank our sponsor. But we haven't got a sponsor. Not if you were the last man on earth. She was prepared to prove it. This one goes out to a special girl. There is no special girl! It's the end of radio! The last announcer plays the last record. The last what? Leaves the transmitter. Circles the globe in search of a listener. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
it really broadcasting if there's no one there to receive? It's the end of radio. As we come to the close of our broadcast day. Radio.